You're listening to A Dark Companion, a Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts podcast. Check out our website at adarkcompanion.com. Follow the show on Twitter at adarkcompanion and Instagram. And follow me on Twitter at apublicwitness. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Lisa Morrow. I played Amanda Maynard on Haunting Melissa. And you're listening to A Dark Companion.
Hi, this is Zero, and you're listening to A Dark Companion, a Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts podcast. I've got another special guest for everybody. Guest, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Lisa Morrow, and I play Amanda Maynard.
Yes, hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good, yeah.
Excellent.
So, I'd like to know just right off the bat, how did you find out about Haunting Melissa and Dark Hearts?
Well, similar to some of your other guests, as I mentioned, I am an actor and I did get a casting call for it. So I received a telephone call from the casting director, I know her from other projects that I've auditioned and worked on. And she called me and sent me the sides for the project. And I had basically received them, had an opportunity to, of course, look through it and go out and audition for it. And it was a great opportunity for sure.
Oh, yeah. And do you recall kind of what the experience was with the audition? Like what did you have to do? I mean, did they have something for you that ended up actually in the movie or?
Yeah, basically the sides that I received were, of course, I received the sides. It was a four and a half page scene. I got the breakdown of who the character was. One thing with Amanda that I'm sure you've noticed is she is got some problems.
Yeah.
She actually has a neurological disorder from being on antipsychotic drugs for so many years.
Oh.
So one of the first troubles hurdles with the, or blessings at the same time with the character was I had to take on some physical, demonstration of this disorder, and whether I did it exactly textbook or not. I think the point was that Amanda just needed to have some real evident troubles. So her disorder that she has is actually called tardive dyskinesia. And tardive dyskinesia is, again, a neurological disorder that comes from being on antipsychotics. So it messes up with your system, your neurological system.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my biggest challenges or one of my biggest initial drives to get the character was to figure out how I could sustain a believable neurological condition over the course of 4.5 pages of dialogue. So when I read the character breakdown and I read the scene, which was amazing, this was in Haunting Melissa 1, I was elated because as an actor, especially an actor in Calgary, who we don't have a huge thriving scene, I was excited to take on the challenge for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I looked at the character. I have some really great acting friends. I'm part of a really strong acting community here. And I basically got in touch with some of my cohorts and said, okay, this is what I want to work on. I need to, I have a friend who does a lot of what's called, what is it called? Med skills. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they, actors are hired to work with, doctors to be doctors in residence to help them to learn to diagnose conditions. So I got in touch with him and I was like, I need your help, Bill, please. Let's do this together. So he had some great tips for me and we worked and worked and worked. And, that was the key. The rest is acting stuff, but this was actually trying to emit a medical condition. So this was, that was the one big challenge with it, but
well, yeah, fun at the same time. Your performance was great. And everything really came across and you really got the sense of how troubled and tortured she is. Although, you know, as the viewer, we couldn't exactly figure out why. And how it relates to, you know, people like Catherine Strode, where she kind of went crazy in a whole different kind of sense. You know, it was interesting to try to figure out, you know, what it is that's causing this. And I didn't know that there was a very specific disorder that she was dealing with. But what is your theory as far as the movie goes? Because I don't know how much you know as far as specifics, but kind of what happened at the Maynard house, you know, like with that character and what kind of brought her to where we see her in the movie.
Well, to answer the first part about your question, I really don't know a whole lot more from exactly what is in Neil and Andrew's head.
Yeah.
But as an actor, I had, again, the blessing of having a character that had a very intense, you know, 4.5 page scene that revealed many parts of what had happened. Mm-hmm. She, Amanda, had the opportunity to recount what had happened. And so I was able to take those bits and create my own backstory of, you know, why did we, you know, kill the animals and eat their hearts? What was the purpose of that? How did we end up in this place in the first place? What, you know, what kind of teenagers were we? Why were we doing this? What would have been our reason? So I personally made up all of my own backstory so that when I was telling these things, I could actually tell them from a place of knowledge. And I know that Amanda was quite she was an innocent. Like, I don't know if it was, I believe, naive. You know, here we are hanging out with all these teenage friends, peer pressure. You know, I followed along. And I think I was immensely affected by everything that happened. And that drove me to insanity in many ways.
Sure,
like,
yeah.
And I think it's a combination between me not being able to deal with the like post-traumatic stress, right? Like not being able to deal with what happened, but also I do see things and I do experience things and there is a haunting happening around me and nobody believes it and nobody can see it and feel it and sense it like I can. So it's a combination between, well, the same way that Melissa was being, they were trying to make her believe that she was crazy.
Right.
And, you know, and there's people that know that there's things happening, but then there's the people on the street that just like, she's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I went through a similar thing. And in the end, I just allowed myself to just be institutionalized. I wasn't a fighter
right.
like Melissa is, right? I was a little bit more weak, I guess,
sure.
in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah, it really seemed to hit Amanda Maynard in some ways harder than everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to do that scene in the chair where the goth girl appears behind you, all wispy and smoky.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely one of the more kind of like iconic, memorable shots in the whole movie.
No, thanks. Yeah, it was cool to do for sure.
Yes. Do you remember like what shooting that was like? I know they had to obviously do stuff in post, but you know, is there anything in particular that was interesting about doing that scene?
Well, again, my scene again was in the halfway house. Mm-hmm. So they did a great job of setting up the scene, setting up the environment. I never had an opportunity to work with Goth Girl in that, in the first Haunting Melissa.
Right.
So it was the first time I had actually worked with her in person. And I, Stephanie, and I had, when I saw her in her makeup and wardrobe and so on, it was scary.
Sure.
She's definitely a scary figure. And we just worked it. Like we worked it. I mean, of course you've heard and you know, cause you've talked with Neil, he's an amazing director right from the audition process. I mean, I didn't elaborate a lot more on the actual audition itself, mm-hmm. but the audition process is like just as wonderful as working with him. We're all there having fun being creative. And so on that scene, even though I just had that one in Haunting Melissa 2, it was set up like he just basically said, let's play with it a few different ways. Sometimes you see her in the doorway, sometimes you don't see her in the doorway. And then we decided to do the one with her behind me. And it's interesting because we did quite a few little alternates of it. And there's one time where she really lays her hands just gently down my shoulders and then starts just dancing those long, creepy fingers sort of down my front and my arms. And it just was like sending shivers. And I had said to Neil, like, Amanda is, I'm just so tortured inside. And I said, anybody else would scream with an open mouth. And I said, but Amanda wouldn't. She's screaming inside.
Right.
So I think there had to be a sound. So I said, I want to do a closed mouth scream. Like I want to do where it's inside of me and it's there and I don't want it to come out, but it has to some way. So I emit this little sort of squealy kind of closed mouth scream because that's what it is. It was super fun.
Yeah, it seems like she really has this disconnection between what's real, what isn't, and this kind of it's crippling fear of mm-hmm. everything that's going on. It really came across. This bigger story in general. Have you watched the films?
Of course, definitely. And I didn't get, as some of the other people said, I didn't necessarily get to, like, didn't sit down and watch it in a traditional sense. I was like you. I was like, I want to see the next scene. So I had to wait to be released in its little way that it does.
Yeah. Which is super effective. I really think that was genius to release it in staggered chapters like that and mm-hmm. really give you time to think about what you just saw and go back over it and also wonder you're gonna get that next chapter.
So
there's lots of mystery, and I find it interesting to see what the cast and crew kind of think of their theories and ideas of what's going on in the story. And I think, well, let's start with The Visitor. What are your thoughts on Fedora the Explorer?
Well, I've always believed that he is a dark figure. Like he is, if not the pure evil himself, he is definitely a key player.
Sure.
Whether it is, whether we that day in the cellar brought forth the devil and this is the devil or the devil's keepers or the devil's messengers or whatever, like it is evil. Always felt he was. And as Amanda, I believe that everything around this whole scenario is evil. There is mm-hmm. no good,
Oh, yeah. My initial thoughts with The Visitor was that, was the bad guy, like the worst of mm-hmm. it all. And when I got the chance to talk to Tom Carey mm-hmm. and he pointed out, I think that's chapter 23, I can't remember. The one where he throws the flash drive, 25, he throws the flash drive into the fire and sits back and kind of does his little laugh. I just thought it was a laugh when I watched it, but then he posed the question, is it a laugh or is it more of a cry? Mm-hmm. And then that completely changed my perspective on everything, and I had to go back and watch it with the idea that maybe someone's holding something over him and that he's a pawn, and then he has his own pawns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, definitely there is, that's the interesting thing, as you've talked a few other times about, that you can watch it, that's the joy of it, is you can watch it again and again, and you can pick up different little tidbits, and it's something that I think, after hearing Tom's, definitely. I mean, there's the layer there, and it's even the questions that you've raised a little bit about the goth girl. And it's interesting because I almost feel in a way sometimes that there's almost two ways to look at it. I can look at it like a viewer, or I can look at it like Amanda.
Sure.
And I mean, Amanda is very afraid. So it's almost interesting to me. I wonder if I change, for example, my appearance and look at the goth girl as being perhaps someone like you have talked about with some other people, almost being a protector in a way. She's looking after us. Karis is looking after us. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, would that change the way that Amanda would come forth if Amanda has a chance to play again?
Right.
I wonder, because I think Amanda truly is afraid of her. She's afraid of everything around that. So yeah, I have to admit, I haven't gone back to try to reanalyze as a viewer, because I'm kind of hold precious to my Amanda.
Sure, oh, of course.
You know, from a performance perspective, but it's definitely interesting, because there is, I can see how, for example, Karis could be considered to be a little bit of a protector, and maybe even the Dark Man could be sad that, you know, maybe they originally had a pathway or a plan, and now things have gotten a little bit out of control, and he doesn't know what's going to happen next. Mm. Who knows, right?
Yeah, because I always wondered why, Karis is appearing to around lots of different people, and some people are, it seems to be, getting killed by her. But other ones aren't. And, you know, Karis is hanging around Amanda and in the halfway home and is around her, but doesn't appear to be actually doing anything to her.
No.
Same thing with Melissa. No. And so, yeah, it really gave me the impression like she's keeping an eye, I don't know why, but keeping an eye on them, but not not really interacting so much.
Yeah.
I wonder what her motivation is for that. If it's just because you guys all did know each other when you were younger and got involved in the whole Maynard House thing. And I don't know. They're really busy.
Yeah, there's lots of relationships that, you know, we had our relationships when we were younger. And obviously we were a very tight group of friends. And, you know, this event happened and some of us were able to just go on with our lives. Other of us weren't able to, and we were able to exist for quite a long time without it breaking open. And, you know, Melissa now gets to be the age somewhat that we were. Mm-hmm. And is it cyclical? Is there a cycle that's happened? Is this the first generation in which this has happened to us, or did this happen in the past? Like, you know, were my parents involved in something as well? I mean, that's another issue. It doesn't appear that it's the first. It appears that it happened in other places around, you know, whether it's around the world or whether it's, you know, in our area, whatever it is, it's not the one and only. It's not a singular event, right?
Oh, no. Yeah. I mean, that's something we'd love to see, is a flashback to everything that happened in the Maynard House. But then I even want to go further with how Karis had the powers that she had. And even with the Lancaster family, how do people find out about any of this to make any kind of deals and do any kind of rituals? How does it come to them? And, you know, the Lancasters are, I think, 200 miles away or whatever from Upton, Kansas. So it's definitely not just in one city, but what, you know, why there? Or is it more than there, you know? Is it a global thing? You know, what is it that makes, is it a certain level of desperation that a family has that seems like an opportunity for the visitor to show up and try to make some kind of deal? And, you know, so much to wonder about. Just so much mystery.
Oh, Neil and Andrew, give us some more clues.
Yeah, I believe I'll have actually Andrew on next week.
Oh, awesome.
And see if I can grill him for information.
Because
it's kind of fun not knowing everything, but you kind of want to know everything.
Yes. Yes, that's absolutely true. And I know I kept thinking, like, you know, even in playing my character, you know, what I had questions about that stuff. But then at the same time, I thought I can just make up my own answers. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, unless it's a pivotal response to something, but then, you know, then Neil would direct obviously what he wants there. But yeah, it was good. I mean, I just had the freedom to play and to be who I thought I should be, which, you know, was obviously the choices were there and they were in agreement with what the storyline was. So
was your experience being on set, is, you know, because this film is obviously designed for things like iPhones and iPads, and it's shot in these kind of chapter ways. Did you notice anything or feel like it was very different from other acting work that you've done, or something unique about it?
Well, I have to say the first Haunting Melissa was definitely a change from the norm, because it was the found footage, because my particular scene was shot with Melissa when she goes into the halfway house and she sets up her iPhone on the table and captures the interview with Amanda. It was a dialogue heavy scene. So normally if you had something on a traditional film set that was, you know, 4+ pages long, you would have umpteen setups. You would have different, you know, they'd shoot it from the wide shot and then they'd shoot my coverage and her coverage and, you know, perhaps the coverage of the nurse walking me in. It would be a whole day, sometimes even more, obviously. Mm-hmm. But because it was found footage, everything was shot in single takes. So you would, you know, from the moment that I walk through the door till the moment I leave, the entire scene is shot in a single shot. And the cool thing about that was obviously the journey could be, if it needed to be, or if it went that direction, it could be slightly different every time because there's no cutting, there's no continuity. It is what it is. Right. So the cool thing about that was every single time we would take it through, and we did it through every time completely from start to finish. And every time I'd shuffle back out of the room around the corner out of shot and just start giggling because it was so much fun. And I would surprise myself sometimes in where the journey took me because, you know, again, I had the freedom to play every time because I didn't have to worry. And then Neil could, of course, choose the one that he thought he wanted to choose, you know. Yeah. And it was super, super fun. And then for Haunting Melissa 2, it was like all of a sudden we went from this little indie project that was very, you know, not on a shoestring by any means, but, you know, very much conscious of budget, to having something that through the success of Haunting Melissa 1, we were able to have the opportunity to have a true film environment. So you had some coverage and you had, you know, you had after dialogue recording to change some things, and you had, you know, a professional photo session where they had a photographer come in to do still shots. And so it was very much like a real set, not real, but you know what I'm saying? Like a traditional, more of a traditional set, but still very much family oriented because Neil has a wonderful way of bringing people together and, you know, was able to bring on mostly the same people. So it was like a reunion of sorts. And yeah, it was definitely, there was a different experience from one to two that way, but both very great in their own way. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it seems like a very, very unique situation to be in, something that, especially the first one, was very, very much independent. And then getting a bigger budget for the next one, but it's still not being a big, you know, Hollywood kind of corporate
impersonal
situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's and you know, Neil hiring right out of Canada and really keeping things local and bringing people back, and it just seems like a really, I would imagine, since I've never done any acting, but a really good environment to work in.
And absolutely.
A place where you can, you know, as creative as he is, it can, you know, you're allowed to be creative as well and really kind of feel things out, and it produced two amazing movies. So I
thanks. Yeah,
definitely. I think, I hope it worked out. How do you see Amanda in the future beyond what we've seen? Do you think she just stays there in the halfway
house? I kind of have, you know, I of course I don't know what Neil and Andrew have in mind, but to me, I feel that if there is something about the goth girl, about Karis, that is protective, I almost feel like there could be maybe some healing. I kind of have thrown around that idea. I mean, the goth girl is with me. And, you know, is there perhaps something that she can offer me as far as, yeah, I mean, she can make people sick.
Sure.
She can make people die. She can give them disease.
Right.
So can she heal? I don't know. I kind of have thrown around with that. I think Amanda definitely has some things to say. And she has perhaps, yeah, I think it's a, right now it's a life kind of lost, or a life sort of in, you know, she's in turbulent water. She's spinning right now. And I think there's definitely, she can exit at any point, I think, but it would take some intervention, I think, for her to build up that strength and that confidence. I mean, she has, as weak as she has survived.
Absolutely.
This long.
Yeah.
Sometimes her survival is succumbing, letting the drugs and the environment give her that escape, but it's not, you know, she wasn't born mentally challenged that way. So she has a mind, but it's very convoluted right now.
Right.
But aware. Because her insanity is because she sees. And what she sees is there. So she's not, she is really seeing what's happening. So it's not in her delusion, right?
You know, it's not at all. And I've wondered, like, if, you know, she's seeing these real things, and especially if you're in a mental facility and you try and tell anybody, that's not going to be good for you. And that's going to mean more medication, and then the medication's going to make you feel worse. And it's just going to be a never ending cycle. So if Karis were to, say, heal her, what side would Amanda fall on? Would she feel obligated to work with Karis and visit her and become another kind of pawn in that whole story, or would she be working to kind of put the genie back in the bottle of what they let out?
Well, the best way I think I could describe it is perhaps she would be on the other side of Caraway. Because Caraway, I think, is on one side. Caraway is a dark figure, and I think Amanda is a light figure. So if the side of lightness, whatever the side of lightness is fighting for, that's who Amanda would be on. And I think that if someone like Karis did turn out to be a positive figure and she did heal, so to say, Amanda, then obviously Karis would be on the side of good, because the only reason why she would be doing that would be because she knows, mm-hmm. she sees, she has power. So she will only carry out what she wanted to, Karis, right? So if, you know, if Amanda were to be healed, then it would be probably her or someone like her that would heal her. And that's who she would fight. She would fight that fight, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting as far as how, you know, teams go in this story, because it's not always so clear cut. I mean, there are some that are obvious, I guess. But, Karis, whether or not she falls on light or the dark side, I mean, she seems like one of the dark people because she's, you know, ghostly and it seems associated with, you know, the Visitor and stuff like that. But the stuff that she's done, like making Mike Cole sick, getting him out of the way, it really felt more like being protective of Melissa. Because he's coming around being very aggressive and really threatening her, and then she gets him out of the way. Now, is that for the benefit of Melissa, or is that to make sure Melissa is able to carry out what she does by the end of the film, where she seems to be more on the dark side of things? So it's and Caraway, I mean, I don't know how she got wrapped up in that whole mess. I mean, is she just a regular person that just picked a side, or what?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, I also feel like when we talk about Mike Cole, for example, and what the way he got the flesh-eating disease as well, it's really, to me, I don't know which thought to have on the dark girl, for sure. I mean, obviously right now as Amanda, I feel she's evil, she's bad, because when we were younger, we had to lock her away.
Right.
To me, that's Karis is, you know, she's the one that we locked in the root cellar. Mm-hmm. So why would she, like, to me, with Mike Cole's whole thing, to me, it was almost a vengeance killing when I read it, or when I saw it, it was a vengeance killing. She's slowly going away and picking away at the people that have, that hurt her or killed her. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So for me as Amanda, she's coming to get me too.
Right.
Right. And as you know, with Barb's care, Mrs. Strogue, right? She was also fearful, but we're also fearful of evil in general. So I don't know. That's where I get, you know, that's where I can't find the exact answer either, because I think, well, you're right in many things that you say. Like, was she protecting Mike Cole? Was obviously striking out against Melissa. So, you know, was she trying to protect Melissa? But then at the same time, is she just following her own path?
Right.
Because Melissa let her out. Melissa opened the door.
Exactly. Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, is that all in timing? Melissa opens the door and now all these things are happening.
Right. Yeah. Timing. So, definitely. Yeah.
I don't know. It's there's so many questions.
Yeah. Cause like it was just thinking while you were talking, if Karis really wanted to go after Amanda, I mean, Amanda's in kind of a position where she's easy to get to. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, she's in that halfway house. She's not going anywhere. And Karis has been up close and personal with her, you know, so she could mm-hmm. do whatever evil thing she wanted to do to her, but she hasn't. Mm-hmm. So it always made me wonder, you know, because I mean, she did go after Mike Cole and took him down. But as far as we know, Amanda's still up and running. So what's her game? What's her plot?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
she's taking her time with it.
Yeah. And is that torture in itself? I mean,
sure.
You know, Amanda's she's not living a good life.
Not at all.
She's living a very tortured life. So is it, you know, is that it? Is it, I'll just let you waste away. I mean, the description to me, Amanda's she's just a sad woman. She's still, you know, one little character thing I'll mention, which is part of my character development, something that Neil and I talked about, was I made a choice in my audition, and we carried it through into the filming, to have in my original audition, I had a really dirty pink bow in my hair. It clipped into the side of my hair, which was quite disheveled. And then I had this dirty pink bow, which actually my girlfriend has a daughter, and it was in her toy box. And it was like one of those bows that was just dirtied up from being shoved in the toy box and played with a million times. So I clipped it into the side of my hair. And to me, it was that lost innocence. I still want to be 16. I'm stuck emotionally at the point that the trauma happened, whether that's 16 or 17. I was, you know, I want to hold on to that innocence that I had, and I'm lost. Like it's a sad situation. It's like, I never, you know, here I am all these years later. And I still we chose to put a flower in my hair, and we painstakingly dirtied it it's not like I went to shopping regularly and got myself a fresh flower.
Right.
I had a dirty old flower in my hair, and that's something that she's just stuck there. She's stuck at that age of innocence, and she wants to go back there desperately, but she can't.
I mean, it's a traumatizing experience. I could see how that would lock you in and make you wish that you were back before then and could do it differently and have never even, you know, opened that box crazy that they seem to have kind of let out.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of shrub looking character that appears in that painting on the wall, like, what is that? Any ideas about what, you know, who that is? Is that one of many like it, or is that the kind of pure evil?
Whatever it was, I do not want to see it again. That's all I know. Yeah, it was, to me, it, again, just a representation of, these are dark things. These are evil things. These are things that you do not want to see. You know, it's, just... I don't know if it's when I think about the pure evil, I think about it's that rough and raw, and it's not put in a pretty box and to look like there's evil that looks like people,
right?
You know, and there's evil that is, something that is, just, it comes from, I don't know. Yeah. Just not the ground or the earth, but you know what I mean? It's just that.
Yeah.
And I think that's what that represents. Just, yeah, it's not good. It's not good.
Well, and speaking of that weird monster thing, what do you think of Adam?
I think Adam, first of all, the little guy did an amazing job. They were filming that scene over not too far from our house, actually, in the community. So we trucked over there that day. So I actually got to see the twig monster.
Oh, really?
And then I got to see, and it was a really hot day. And the guy that played him was just like having to put on that massive suit. We got to go to the house and the Lancaster house and all that, and watched a few little scenes with the boy. Unfortunately, I didn't have any scenes with Adam, but it looked like, you know, I know everyone was saying what a great job. And I mean, we can see that he did a great job of portraying that, that awkwardness and that, just doesn't fit into, traditional mold there. Right. Where, you know, he's definitely, and I think he's, again, if we can take evil or, the next generation, I mean, if this is something that carries on and carries on in our form, in a human form, I think he's the human form, right? Mm-hmm. And it starts with him and the mind, again, it's taking that innocence. I think that probably gives power too.
Sure.
Because, I mean, we know how moldable children are. So if you take something in that base form and you nurture it and mold it, you're going to get an even more powerful adult figure, right?
Oh, of course.
If you can start them when they're young. And I think whether he's, you know, almost like that Rosemary's Baby thing or something, where you get something that's born and then it will grow and become, it's born of evil, though. I think Adam came from, however they're cultivated.
I was going to ask, like, where do you think Adam came from? Like, how does the visitor just have a kid that he can deliver?
Like, I don't know.
And is that his normal thing? Because there were moments where I started questioning, like, did he drop off Melissa with the Strokes? Is she not even really related? Like, you just start wondering.
Or even Karis.
Yeah, even Karis. Yeah,
in a way, I really feel like that question raised with me is, you know, there's so little conversation about Karis that was, is that why? Is right. It almost like, think about, will the Lancaster family, will they be chatting about, like, you know, if something happened to Adam, would the Lancasters continue to talk about him, or would he just be gone?
Right. Yeah.
That, because I always wonder, like, that it's interesting that Melissa never even knew she had an aunt. Why didn't they talk about her? So,
because, you know, like, she wasn't really, you know. She...
Mm-hmm.
So then if Karis gets dropped off with the Strogue grandparents, let's say, so then... Or, you know, well, I got, well, so. Start tripping around on, like, time.
Yeah, there's
time frames.
So many questions. Yeah.
Because, like, I picture it initially, like, Karis would get dropped off with, I guess, Catherine's parent.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, and then this thing goes back even further in time, and then how did they, like, what kind of deal? What kind of deal is everybody making? We know that the Lancasters clearly wanted to have their life improved and fix all their problems and job issues and marriage and things like that. And, you know, what kind of other deals have happened? And do they, when they work out, do they stay worked out? Or is this kind of one of those things that after the visitor gets what he wants... done with you. I don't know. Whatever Adam was doing in the shed, do you feel like that was similar to the Maynard House kind of ritual?
I think it's a juvenile depiction. I think it definitely, to me, felt like it had the beginnings of, I mean, perhaps he's a more powerful version, or perhaps he gets it sooner. I mean, I definitely feel that Karis had something that we all thought was, you know, as a teenager who feels infallible, we all thought was cool. We all thought was something, oh, wouldn't that be interesting? We could have powers like she has. I mean, I depict that she had powers. So it was ceremonies that she had done on her own, almost like when you look at teenagers fooling around with a Ouija board or some of those weird things that people, you know, talk about doing. You know, everyone flirts with that a little bit when they're in that age. And whether she had something that we saw and we're like, oh, that's so cool, or whether she always had it. And because she was this slightly odd duck and we were attracted to that kind of, and, you know, she was kind of weird, but she still had these cool powers, and how did she get them? And because, you know, I threw around in my mind with how close were we? Like, how close were we all with Karis that we, right, we could do something? And then obviously we were, I felt close enough to her, or I felt bad enough about what happened that it messed me up. But where did that come from? And so with Adam, same thing, like he's doing these rituals just like we were trying to do the rituals. And, you know, he's obviously already getting to a very scary place or a very evil place, mm-hmm, but he might be more powerful. There might be some who are better conveyors of the evil than others. Right.
Right.
And then, but then who knows what other things Karis was involved in when she was Adam's age. I mean, right, she's, yeah, carrying out her stuff.
I just had this image in my head, and you'd said that it was kind of like a juvenile version of it. And then I started to think, well, maybe Adam's not in there in that shed and acting as a portal to bring the shrub monster over, but is being instructed and taught by the shrub monster in the shed.
Yeah.
And kind of grooming him to be, I don't know, the next Fedora the Explorer? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, maybe he's just in there learning how to do things. And it's not that doing whatever he did with that toy is what brought the shrub monster there, because it's like, well, is there more than one shrub monster, or can he only kind of come and go? Because, you know, the Maynard House ritual appears to have brought him over. But, mm-hmm, then where does he go? What does he do once he's here? So, yeah. Man, much to wonder about. Well, Elisa, it's been great talking to you. I really appreciate the opportunity. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the audience out there?
Well, I think we've all said it. Just keep on watching, keep on asking questions, keep on following. Tell everyone you know. You know, we want to keep telling stories, and we want to build this. We want to ride this great wave that Neil and Andrew have started for us and Hooked Media. It's, mm-hmm, it's really fun, and it's just as fun being in it and not knowing the answers, you know, it's all creative. I mean, that's what it does, is it sparks that creativity in all of us. And, yeah, just thanks so much for supporting us and for supporting the film.
Oh, not a problem.
And thanks to you, Zero, for your contribution.
Thank you.
For giving us a voice. I mean, it's so wonderful for me as a performer to be able to share a little bit about my journey and hopefully, you know, bring a little bit of clarity or a little bit of inspiration to somebody else out there.
Yeah, and I'd like to extend to you a open invitation to be on the show again if you would like, because I'd love to talk to you more and find out more, especially as things go on and hopefully other movies come out.
Yes.
really, really want a third one.
Me too.
Because, you know, I don't want, you know, perfect resolution of everything. I just want to see more, and I want more mysteries to try to figure out. So,
mm-hmm,
we will see, and I'm hoping for it.
Definitely.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks,
I really appreciate,
Zero,
it. All right.
No problem.
You have a great day.
Thanks, Zero.
Bye.
Bye.